Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Adjective, four syllables, maybe the most important word in the economic world right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnell. It is Tuesday today, August 3rd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We got last week from one Jerome Powell, chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, something of a vocabulary lesson.
What I mean by transitory is just something that doesn't leave a permanent mark on the inflation process. Again, I don't mean that you know, producers are going to take those price increases back. That's not the idea. It's just that they won't go on indefinitely.
Transitory inflation does not mean disappearing inflation. That is important. So we are going to begin today with those producers Chair Powell was talking about. Their costs of goods sold, all the supplies and raw materials and inputs, have been getting more expensive. Supply chain problems and higher demand. We've been talking about that. But that leaves them on the horns of something of a dilemma, how and when to pass those costs along to customers. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gets us going.
It seems like everything James Malios has to buy is getting more expensive. He owns a few high-end restaurants in New York, like Amali, a Greek spot in Manhattan, and Bar Marseille, a French restaurant in Queens. And well, first of all, there's the food.
Yeah, shrimp is bad. Steak.
Lamb, it's all getting pricier. So we can't even change the menu, you know, swap out one dish for another to keep prices down.
It's like there's no refuge.
He also buys things like cleaning supplies and napkins and toilet paper for the restaurants.
It's like you're paying the same that you used to pay for, like, you know, whatever, the Charmin, like, super gentle, like, you know, oh, this is lovely toilet paper, and you're getting, like, the economy roll for the same price.
And yet, Malios has only raised menu prices at one of his four restaurants recently.
It's not that I don't think I should. It's just that every restaurateur is always skittish about raising prices because they're afraid of the customer reaction, you know. But economically, like, by the book, yeah, everyone, we should have raised everything 20%, like, you know, 2 months ago.
There's always that fear. Customers get used to paying a certain amount for a steak or an order of lamb chops. And to them, that's the fair price. In Washington, D.C., Amina Ahmad owns a soy candle shop called Handmade Habitat. Mostly she sells online. And she has a system for making pricing decisions. She keeps a spreadsheet with the cost of every single material and supply.
Everything from the wick to the little sticker that goes underneath the wick that makes it centered on the candle, to the warning label, to the lids.
And that spreadsheet is telling her to raise prices. I mean, take the cost of soy wax.
It was probably about $60 for a 50-pound box of wax at the beginning of the pandemic, and it's up to $75 to $100 now.
Like Malios, she's had to think about how long she can absorb these cost increases.
Sometimes you just think maybe you can sit on this for a while, but after a certain amount of time, like after a few months of it not going down, like we just can't.
Because she'd be losing money, and this is basically a one-woman business. She depends on it for income. So last year, she raised prices between May and July, an off-season, but she was thinking ahead to the holidays.
Because that's the biggest time of year for us. Like, we can't afford to be losing money on every order during December.
The funny thing was, when she did raise prices, people were willing to pay more. She hasn't seen sales drop. Neither has Mark Merle, CEO of Get Maine Lobster in Portland.
We provide lobster dinners, lobster rolls, fish dishes to anyone in the continental U.S., dock to doorstep.
He says the cost of lobster at the dock has doubled over the past year, so he's raised his prices too.
Yeah, for example, we sell a lobster roll kit. It serves 8 people, and we had to increase our price dramatically.
from $160 to $225.
And that didn't really impact sales.
Still, a lot of business owners are wary of increasing prices. Katie Stack owns a company in Virginia called Stitch and Rivet, which makes and sells leather goods and canvas bags. She says the prices she pays for materials, like metal parts and leather hides, have gone up. So while doing some necessary redesigns this year, she also raised her prices. Like her olive green crossbody zipper bag went from $199 to $232. Here's the thing, though.
Whenever we increase prices, I've always tried to be sure that I'm not just offering people the exact same thing at a higher price. There's nicer hardware, or there's a nicer zipper, or there's a nicer leather handle, or there's more value added.
Because as a small business owner, she says she can't afford to have unhappy customers. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, I'll tell you what, people, find yourself somebody who loves you like traders love this economy, huh? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This past Sunday was the single busiest travel day for commercial aviation, that is, since the pandemic started. 2.2 million people went through TSA checkpoints. It's been over 2 million people 5 days in a row now, the longest that streak has been since February of last year. However, most of those people are moving around within the United States, and most of the traveling is personal. Business travel's been a lot slower to recover, and a new report suggests it's going to take a long while for it to come back. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that one.
Airlines make a lot of their money on business travelers. David Slotnick at the travel site The Points Guy says that's because
you have people who are booking last-minute fares, maybe. They're less price-sensitive. Their companies are paying for it.
But between April and June, companies were only spending about 10 or 15% of what they used to on travel before the pandemic. That's according to a new report from Deloitte. Anthony Jackson worked on the report, and he says the travel that has come back revolves mostly around client visits.
Doing a new sale, building relationships, project work that requires being on site. Those are really kind of key activities that companies are viewing and understanding are really important to do in person.
But things like internal company meetings and trainings, those aren't really happening yet. And Kate Lister at Global Workplace Analytics says that kind of travel might never be as common again.
What we've learned is that good enough is good enough. It may not be as good to have a virtual meeting, but it gets you 70, 80, sometimes 90% of the way there.
And it's a lot cheaper. Many companies have been saving money by holding back on business travel. Meanwhile, there's the Delta variant. COVID cases are rising again. Many offices are still closed. And Suzanne Neufung at the Global Business Travel Association says international travel, which is particularly lucrative for airlines, is still heavily restricted.
U.S. is not allowing at this point non-American or green card holders into this country.
From many countries.
So a lot of the suppression is some of the U.S. policy itself.
And Neufung says until more of the world has access to vaccines, business travel won't fully recover. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This has been a rough year for ketchup lovers. I mean, it's been rough for a lot of us for a lot of reasons, but ketchup lovers in particular. You remember back a couple of months ago when people were selling those little Heinz packets on eBay for $4 a pop because of a pandemic-induced shortage of them? Well, it might be time to start saving the Happy Meal condiments again. They are turning into an asset class all by themselves. The drought we're having out here in California, we are by far the country's biggest tomato producer. That drought is going to take 5 to 10% off crop yields. So says the California Tomato Growers Association. So yes, grain of salt, to continue with the food theme of this introduction and in a way the whole program. But the price of everything from marinara sauce to salsa to, yes, ketchup could be on the rise. Marketplace's Matt Levin has this one.
We're going to go on a brief tour of the tomato supply chain, starting in California's Central Valley, where a third of the world's canned tomatoes are grown.
Our harvester, I'm watching it go back and forth in the field right now.
Bruce Rominger grows processing tomatoes, the kind that end up in cans. Fresh tomatoes are also in short supply, but processing tomatoes are taking the biggest drought hit. Instead of surface water, farmers are switching to well water, which ain't so great.
But the higher salt content will diminish the yield in the field.
It's not just the drought. Rominger is now getting $85 a ton for tomatoes. But in years past, he says the price canneries were offering wasn't enough.
We've seen more and more land taken out of the tomato production into orchards, primarily almonds and pistachios.
Andy Resick is head of marketing at Sacramento area cannery Pacific Coast Producers, which makes stewed tomatoes and tomato paste. He says rising tin and freight costs are also sending prices up.
Which is unfortunate because we have this willing consumer base that just learned from a year of pandemic how important canned tomatoes are.
Consumers that include restaurants. Patrick Mulvaney is the owner and head chef at Mulvaney's B&L in Sacramento. He relies on fresh tomatoes in summer, but in winter,
when tomatoes in cans are your option, then becomes time for heartier sauces, deep, rich ragouts with lamb shanks.
The shortage could have a big impact on the dishes he makes.
You're using it just to put a dab of flavor in, rather than having it be the star of the show.
Wonder how well mustard goes with lamb shank. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
I think mustard probably goes all right with lamb shank. I don't know. What do you think? Okay, so if this is Tuesday, which it is, this must be a podcast call out. We've got one, you know, if you miss us on the air. Check it out, marketplace.org or the platform of your choice. Coming up,
so we grow under lights that actually can mimic the spectrum of the sun.
The future of farming, perhaps. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 278 points on this Tuesday, 0.8%, finished at 35,116. The NASDAQ picked up 80 points, a little bit more than 0.5% there, 14,761. The S&P 500 added 35 points, 0.8%, 44.23. Sam Fields' piece on the state of the business travel is a good opportunity to check in on that sector. American Airlines down about 0.5% today. Delta added 0.8%. United picked up a full percent. Wyndham Hotels and Resorts down 1.2%. Marriott, whose CEO said today corporate bookings for most of July were down 45% from the same period in 2019. Well, Marriott gave up 1.5%. That tomato shortage that Matt Levin was telling us about did not hold down shares of Kraft Heinz. It picked up 0.9% today. Bond prices were unchanged. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note finished at 1.17%. Think about it. 1.17%. That's like crazy low. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know what's been busy lately? Beverages. There has been a lot going on. Pepsi's going to be selling Tropicana and some of its other juice brands to a private equity firm. That is a $3.3 billion deal. Meanwhile, Molson Coors is going to start phasing out 11 of what it calls its economy brands. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looked into the ever-changing beverage market amid ever-changing consumer tastes.
When you think of Molson Coors, you probably think of inexpensive beers you throw back at a baseball game or a dive bar or, once upon a time, a college dorm party. Phil Guana, CEO of Edge Beverage Consulting, says that image isn't aging so well.
The landscape for beverage is continuously evolving and changing, and it's really a demand for something different than grandpa's beer.
He says brands are looking to lock in 20-somethings and women, a growing demographic in the alcoholic drinks category. And even non-alcoholic drinkers have been trending away from PepsiCo's sugary juices and soft drinks. Consumers want seltzer, prebiotic sodas, and kombucha.
All these drinks are now promising us Instagrammable health.
Andrea Hernandez writes Snackshot, a food and beverage newsletter. She says consumers are constantly on the hunt for the new hip drink. And for drink makers to stay relevant,
you either adapt or you're going to become obsolete.
Molson Coors is adapting by getting rid of lower performing drinks like Keystone Ice and High Life Light. The company says this will allow it to beef up its supply chains for making Topo Chico hard seltzer and distributing La Colombe canned coffee. Drinks that Jim Watson, a beverage analyst at Rabobank, says may come with bigger profit margins. Plus, cutting some brands could give the company room to invest in innovation.
They're searching for that new big hit. Because if you get that new big hit, you know, you can have this transformative change.
A few years ago, that new big hit was White Claw, which started the hard seltzer fad. Companies want to create the new it drink, not chase it. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Okay, one last story from that trip to New York I took a couple of weeks ago. A story not, as it happens, actually in New York. Half an hour in an Uber, and I was at one of those warehouse complexes you see along the New Jersey Turnpike. Found the right one, and inside met Irving Fain.
How are you?
Good, I'm Kai.
Kai, Irving.
Nice to see you, Irving. How are you?
It's your first work trip, I heard.
First work trip in 18 months.
Thank you.
The company is called Bowery Farming. Fain started it in 2015. It is now the biggest vertical farming company in the country, which you will understand better in a minute. They've got two farms, a third on the way, growing leafy greens and herbs that are sold in nearby stores and restaurants. Before I could go all the way inside, though, had to do that protective gear thing, lab coat, booties, the whole deal.
So the only thing about radio is you don't get to talk about how cool everyone looks like in a hairnet. Right?
We went through a series of doors, and then into the research and development farm.
Can I just say this is very laboratory looking?
It is.
Oh, whoa. All right, you know what's funny? It smells vaguely farmy, vaguely like organic.
That's actually oftentimes the first things people say when they walk inside is they say, wow, it actually smells like a farm.
Yeah.
And in truth, it is a farm. Because what is a farm other than an area where we grow plants?
Fair.
That's exactly what we're doing here. Fair. We're just doing it in a way that doesn't necessarily look like the children's books we all grew up reading.
Okay, so not only does it smell like a farm, or it smells like a farm, but it kind of doesn't look like a farm because there's all kinds of like steel and industrial stuff. So
you know what it looks like? It looks like a modern farm, and that's exactly what it is.
All right, so tell me what we're looking at.
What you see here is essentially the growing area in our farm. This was our very first farm. It has since been converted over to all R&D. And we actually stack our crops from the floor all the way up to the ceiling.
So this is four layers. It's got to be, what, 20 feet high, 25 feet high, right?
Five layers, I think, or even more.
Right. One, two, three, four.
Yeah, six.
Oh, yeah, maybe six, yeah. All right, so I can't count. And what are you doing here? I mean, why do you need R&D for a farm?
Well, so what we're doing here is we're growing in an indoor environment. So we grow under lights that actually can mimic the spectrum of the sun. And because of the way we grow in this controlled and contained way, we can grow 365 days of the year, independent of weather, independent of seasonality.
24-hour sunshine.
So we actually, plants need rest, too.
That's so interesting.
They do, but they don't necessarily need as much rest as they get outside, right?
Right.
So when you start to ask that question earlier about why do you need a lab, when you can all of a sudden control these outside variables, there's so many opportunities.
Okay, so don't take this the wrong way, but there's a little bit of mad scientist going on here. We can control everything,
But here's what's great. Every one of our crops is getting all of the things that they need to grow and that they would get outside. And what they don't have is all of the challenges with pests and the waste of water that happens. We use a small fraction of water compared to traditional farming, and we're over 100 times plus more productive than a square foot of farmland.
Let's walk a little bit. Yeah. Show me what's going on.
Well, so we're walking towards a couple of trays where our crops are actually growing. And so what you can see here
I'm trying to identify this stuff. I have no clue.
So you want to take a guess? One of these you'll get.
So that one's basil. That's easy.
You got that one. But it's actually not basil. It is basil, but it's basil, a specific type basil? Of basil. Okay. It's a lemon basil, which we're going to try in a second.
All right. What are the other on the table here? What is that?
So this is wasabi arugula.
Oh, I'm a big arugula guy, but that doesn't look like regular arugula.
So it is not the arugula that you've had and are probably familiar with. It's a natural occurring crop. It's just incredibly difficult to grow in Germany.
Huh.
And so it's something that you rarely would ever find outside in your day-to-day life.
That's cool.
And something that we've been growing consistently for almost 6 years now.
So let's say these crops come to harvest.
Yep.
And here we are, I don't even know how many miles we are from Manhattan. 10 maybe?
Yeah.
So do you throw it on a truck and get fresh produce like same day into a restaurant in Manhattan? Is that the deal?
That's exactly right. People's first impression of what we're doing at Bowery is, wow, you're reinventing farming. No question. What we're really doing here, though, is reinventing the entire fresh supply chain.
Can you make money doing that?
That's exactly why you can make money. Crops like this take 2 to 3 weeks plus to reach us normally, whereas all of our supply chain exists in this one building, and we deliver a product a day or two from harvest to when it actually reaches you as a customer.
That's crazy. 2 to 3 weeks. That's a long time.
It is. You can judge for yourself.
Let's go.
Okay,
where
let's
are we
do
going?
It. All right. So you're getting a sense of all the products
we
have.
So we should say, right? So is that kale? I tried the kale. Surprisingly, didn't hate it. Tried a bunch of other stuff, too. So look, I'm not a radish guy.
Okay.
My dad used to have them in his salads all the time, so I've had some, but it's been a while. Seemed a very average radish to me.
Wow.
You know. So that's, that was one loser out of five that I've had.
I appreciate it. You're a tough critic.
Well, I'm not a vegetarian.
The strawberries were excellent. Also, something called green sorrel, which was new to me.
Ooh. Wow. There's a lot of lemon juice in there.
Yeah, it's amazing, right?
How did you do that?
I'm going to keep going back to what you started and you said, why do you need a lab or why do you need R&D in farming?
This is why you need the lab.
So if you think about outdoor agriculture, there's essentially three things they care about when they choose what they grow. It's got to resist pests, and it's got to resist drought on the field, and then it has to travel well and look good when it shows up.
Right.
And if it doesn't hit those areas, it doesn't matter.
Right.
So taste and quality, variety, all these things go out the window in service of those three attributes. I mean, you say, I'm not really a produce guy, and a lot of the reason is produce has gotten pretty unexciting.
It's completely boring. That's what I try to tell my wife when she makes a salad.
But the problem is it doesn't have to be boring. It's boring because what we've really selected for is how do we get mass quantities of cheap food to people on a regular basis.
This is going to sound stupid, but do you need anything more than like a couple of big warehouses to do this? I mean, yes, the internal hardware and all that, but fundamentally, all you need is a couple of warehouses.
So it's what's really powerful about the model. When I got started, for me, one of the things that mattered so much is how do you do this scalably?
Right.
And scalably meant not only how do you make sure it's replicable, but how do you grow large volumes of crops and a large variety of crops at a consistent high quality and ultimately at a price point that opens up a large opportunity? Like, how do we democratize access to high quality fresh food? That's why we employ the technology we do. And all we need, as you said, is empty warehouse space.
Right. So you mentioned democratizing access to fresh produce like this. I'm going to guess this is in all kinds of Whole Foods every place, but not yet in bodegas and corner stores.
You'd actually be surprised. So we're in Whole Foods, but we also work with Safeway, Albertsons, Walmart.
Oh.
So we actually sell to a wide range of retailers. And I think one of the misconceptions is that high-quality produce is something that only people who are wealthy care about, when in reality, people of all different economic stations care about what they eat and care about what they feed their families. And so we're really interested in how can we use technology and innovation to democratize access, to bring what you just tried here to more people wherever they are.
Yeah. Irving, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much, Kai.
Good stuff. I'm going to steal another strawberry.
I was going to say, now what we have to do is I'm going to go.
This final note on the way out today, in which maybe, just maybe, Our long national supply chain nightmare might be a step or two closer to being over. A survey out this week from the Institute for Supply Management, literally supply chain is in their name, it shows prices manufacturers are paying fell in June by the most in almost a year and a half. Said the guy who runs the survey, supply and demand dynamics appear to be moving closer to equilibrium for the first time in many months. That would be a good thing. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context, staying true to the longstanding policy of this program that if we stop talking about this stuff, we're going to stop talking about it. Today is equal pay day for black women in this economy. That is, black women had to work until today, 215 days into 2021, to make what the average white guy made in just the 366 days of 2020. 2020 was a leap year. Don't at me about that one. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mebadolu, Olga Oxman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.